Jim Shoemaker, Drew Johnson, and Scott Jordan are registered representatives and investment advisor representatives of Securian Financial Services, Inc., securities dealer, member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor. Shoemaker Financial is independently owned and operated.
Helping you make the most of your money, it's time for Talk Money. Now, your host, Jim Shoemaker.
Whether you're a baby boomer or a millennial, it doesn't seem to matter. A common concern is always money. Well, welcome to today's program. I'm Jim Shoemaker, and I've got exciting guests today. We've got Drew Johnson and Scott Jordan. They do always a great job. It's a great program lined up for you. You got a lot of information, education. And with these guys, we always throw a little fun just to keep it for good measure. And we're going to talk about estate planning basics and managing managers. Managing the mutual fund managers that a lot of us invest in, such an important part of a program. And we're going to answer a question. And the question's from John. And John says, does this banking problem on the West Coast affect me? Now, guys, it's a great question. So I'm going to start with you, Drew. Scott.
Well, I think it certainly starts people questioning, you know, all banks. So I think, does it have an effect? It certainly could. But I think I would applaud the Fed for stepping in quickly. And basically, I was looking at some data going back to Q2 of last year, and FDIC data shows that about $10.5 trillion is sitting in banks in uninsured deposits. That means deposits above the $250,000 limit.
How much was that number again?
$10.5 trillion. That compares to about $7.5 trillion that's sitting in FDIC-insured deposit limits. So there's a lot more deposits sitting in banks that aren't insured than are insured. So I think it was smart of the Fed to jump in very quickly, you know, provide the liquidity that banks could possibly need in the event that depositors start to withdraw a lot of money out of banks.
That's a good point, and I think John's asking the question. Obviously, the Fed reacted quickly. That's important. I mean, they make depositors whole. They decided, you know, from a standpoint of this, they created that the idea that, you know, they can hold money, excess funds, the banks can at par value instead of marking to market. That was a big deal. But let me ask you this, because I've had other people ask me, not John. John just asking about does it affect him. But I've had other people to ask, why do we bail out depositors above the $250,000 number? I mean, FDIC says it's $250,000. If you got more money and you just told me $10.5 trillion, that kind of answers my question.
I was going to say, that's kind of why we do it. So I understand the sentiment of, hey, you know, why are we always jumping to rescue these wealthy bankers out of their bad decisions? And I think that the answer to that question is the opposite, or the corollary to that decision of not doing it, the situation could get a lot worse. Because, you know, you think about it, you know, these depositors, these $10.5 trillion that are sitting there, if they think there's a chance that that money won't be there, what are they going to do? They're going to all run and try to pull that money out of banks and put it somewhere safe. That's going to cause a collapse of the system. So
I think that's important. We appreciate John's question. And John just asked, he says, does the banking crisis affect me? And he kind of implies in Shelby County, Memphis, Tennessee. And I like that question. And Drew, I guess I'm asking you, you know, there's some consequences to the problem. And so really, when you think about it, raising interest rates is what we've been doing for the last year. And we've been raising interest rates. I mean, it's unprecedented how we've done it. Fastest pace in U.S. history.
Right.
From 0 to 4% in less than a year. And that's since January of last year, in the 12-month period. So in every tightening cycle, that's what it is, there are consequences.
Yeah. I mean, whenever you raise the short-term rates like we've done over the last year, one of the byproducts of that, unfortunately, is that it makes the lending environment very unprofitable for banks. But, you know, we've been seeing all in the news, it was the second largest bank failure in history, followed by the third largest failure one business day later. And that sounds bad, and in a way it is bad, but I think we have to keep it in perspective. Those two companies, by market cap, were less than 0.5% of the financials part of the index. Less than 0.5%. And this, you know, the first one is a top 20 bank. So still less than 0.5%. It's not the entire banking system. It's these couple of banks. And, you know, if you've got a town at the bottom of a mountain and you know that by hauling a few boulders up the mountain, you can stop an avalanche, you're going to do that. And that's what the Fed did here. It's not that they're trying to rescue this one bank because there's something special about it. It's because they don't want the same thing to happen to, you know, the next 5 or 6 or 10 or 60 down the line. It's about containing a problem. You know, it's just like when firefighters show up to put out a house that's on fire. It's not because that particular house is more important than everyone else's, but it's to prevent the entire neighborhood from going up in flames.
That's a great analogy. I like that. That's a, wow.
Yeah, you know, Drew always comes up with something.
You know, I mean, the bottom line is, you know, I mean, Tyler, you know that. Got smart people in here, man. This is good. I always like it. I guess, let me ask this, though, because I think it's, you know, you hear it on the news. We've been listening to it all week, and it's just something we have to discuss. Mismanagement. I mean, from a standpoint of mismatched assets, Scott, what do you say? I mean, this is, I mean, I hate to say this, that you're managing a big bank like this, and I just hate to accuse somebody of mismanagement, but it sure looks like it.
And I don't know that we know all the details yet, but it certainly looks like there was an asset liability mismanagement in that a lot of this money was invested, you know, these deposits were invested in longer term securities, mostly very safe securities like treasuries or agency backed mortgages. So these are good, solid investments. The problem is there's interest rate risk there. So if you have to turn around in the market and sell those assets at any point in time to create the liquidity you need to meet withdrawals, well, now you're having to sell those at a loss. And that's exactly what happened here. They turned around. They had to sell some of their treasury securities, and I think they were down about $1.8 billion in these securities that they sold. And so the market got wind of that, and that's kind of what sparked the whole thing and started people wanting to pull their money out.
And again, you know, I appreciate John's question. The question is, does this banking crisis on the West Coast affect me here in Shelby County, West Tennessee? I hope we've given you some insight, John. I think it's a great question. Just remind you, if you've got questions, send them to Jim, J-I-M, 901-683-0989, or you can send them to talkmoney@shoemakerfinancial.com. We'll try our best to get your questions on the air, and we appreciate the fact that John sent the question. It's a great question. We're going to try to always answer your questions. And actually, Drew, this leads into really your topic for the day, because what Scott was saying is that mismanagement, maybe, if we were to say that, and maybe more stocks or more bonds where they shouldn't be or whatever, all those things we could talk about. But we look at managing money using a lot of mutual fund managers. And I guess I really want to lead in to help us on this subject. What is portfolio management? Give us kind of a definition of that.
Well, you know, it's not just a matter of cash coming into a portfolio and then you going out and saying, oh, what do I think is a good investment? And then just going out and buying it and then selling what you need to cover cost needs. It's really not how portfolio management works. You have to have diversification in your portfolio. And that was part of the problem with this bank situation is they didn't have a diverse client base. They really specialized in a niche market, namely tech companies. And so the problem there was that when the tech sector declined last year, it affected the entire, you know, all the companies in that space. And so they all fell to cash crunch at one time, which meant you were going to see a surge in your withdrawals all at one time. And that caused a big part of the problem. And that wasn't the only area where they weren't diversified. They were under-diversified in terms of what they invested their excess deposits in as well. Well, I mean, the same kind of logic applies to controlling an investment portfolio that's consisting of mutual funds. A good portfolio is not going to consist solely of stocks. Even if it's 100 stocks, it's not going to be a stocks all belonging to one or two industries, certainly not one or two sub-industries, but it's going to represent in some way the entirety of what the U.S. economy is supposed to look like.
When you talk about that, where it's the entire economy, I want to remind people that whether we're talking about diversification or asset allocation, whatever you're talking about, that does not guarantee against loss. And you can understand that I can be well diversified in a portfolio, but that doesn't guarantee the loss. But it is a method that we use and managers use to manage risk. And again, I think what you just said, the banking group didn't quite do that the way they should have. And that's the managing risk. They had, you know, again, a lot of money in 30-year treasuries. And that would have thought, well, that's risk averse. That's about as safe as it can get. That's not managing risk in what we're trying to say.
No, it's not. I mean, they bought into assets that were going to decline in value once interest rates began rising as the economy recovered. And it ended up just really not being a good thing. They got themselves into a financial hole that they couldn't get out of. And so the way that we look at it is we want managers that are going to be paying very, very close attention to what the companies that they're buying are really doing kind of under the hood, so to speak. And we just need to make sure that they're doing what they say that they're going to be doing.
And so let's talk about that. I want to dive into that. Scott, I mean, tell me what your thoughts are.
Well, I think that, you know, when we talk about diversification, I think this is an important lesson learned through this failure, is that you're not only diversifying by types of investment, but also by time, right? So we always say liquidity kills you quick. And, you know, you go back to some of our tenets of investing, and we always encourage people to pay down debt, create an emergency fund before they start investing, because liquidity is important. Now, again, you can have great investments that are solid for long term, but if you need that money today, you may have to go into the market and sell it at a loss in order to get it, right?
And that's when you're taking a loss when you don't want to.
Exactly. So that's exactly what happened to this bank, is not paying attention to just solid financial principles of you need to keep. Now, I don't think there, you know, I go back to say, I don't think there was an amount of liquidity that they could have responsibly had on hand to stop the large surge in withdrawals that they had. But this does highlight the need to, you know, people get a little excited sometimes and they'll have cash sitting in the bank. They want to put it to work, but it's like, okay, let's pause for a minute. When are you going to need this money? When are you possibly going to need this money? Because you always don't know why you're going to need it. And that's why it's important to have that emergency fund, that liquidity on hand.
You really kind of alluded to it. They get this money into the savings account, and all of a sudden they kind of want to put it.
Especially when the market's doing well.
We might call that greed.
Well, you can. I call it fear of missing out, just to soften it a little bit. But
I think what happens is you get that emotion.
It's a natural.
Hey, the market's going up. We talked to somebody the other day that in 2018, 2019, 2020, the market went up. He's making tons of money.
Right.
Everything was great. He's a hero. He's the best investment manager ever. He's doing it yourself. And, you know, then all of a sudden in 2022, I mean, he's lost everything. He's depressed. He's losing weight. I mean, those are big issues.
They are.
That's what
they
we're
are.
Talking about.
Yep,
fear
absolutely.
Of missing out is another way of saying it wasn't greed, it was envy. We're just going to swap one deadly sin for another.
Very much.
All right. We're talking about portfolio management. My guest, Scott Jordan, Drew Johnson. Now, Scott, I mean, well, let me go to Drew, because I really want to. Drew, when we talk about your job in our office is to manage managers. I mean, you dive into the weeds. Now, I don't want you to take us all there to the weeds, but when you screen for things like performance, risk, and cost, that's only the first step. That's only the first little, that's way at the top. You go much deeper than that. It's very important. When you're managing managers, what do you do?
I mean, we do look at performance, and I mean, that's an important objective factor to look at, but we, as you said, we certainly go a lot deeper than that. I mean, we want to know everything we can. We want to know what that manager's education and experience has been. We want to know how long have they been managing the fund? What has that fund's track record been during that manager's tenure? Has the manager been able to keep the fund's expenses under control? How do they look versus their peers? How diversified are they? How concentrated are they? In other words, we don't want to own someone that only has, you know, 20 stocks or something in the portfolio. We want a broadly diversified portfolio.
Now, you're doing this not only by an analysis. You've also got third-party people that you're pulling analysis from that they're doing, but you're also taking the time out and talking to the manager.
We do have conference calls with members of the management team, sometimes directly with the manager himself or herself. We also do subject our portfolios to regular scrutiny by third parties to see if there are any potential blind spots to what we're doing or any areas where we could make some improvements, whether major or minor. We do that typically on a quarterly basis, so fairly regularly from multiple different third parties.
I like what you're saying because you're really telling me that you're looking for the consistency in a manager. You're looking for, are they looking for opportunities? Are they looking to make, you know, maybe a defensive move or an offensive move? Are they active, not just passive? All of those things play into selecting a manager to manage a portfolio. And now you're not trying to do 7,000 managers. You're working with basically 65, 75 managers.
That's right. We've got about between 85 and 90 funds in our lineup total across all of our portfolios. And so, you know, and some of those are index strategies, but for the most part, they're active strategies. And so we have to keep up with all of those. And we have some fiduciary software that helps us do that as well that will provide scoring. That usually gives us an idea of where we need to concentrate our efforts with where to look. But we look at everything. We look at all the funds. We look at all the metrics. We look at the subjective factors as well. We look at what the overall economy is doing, how we think that's going to impact these various funds. We look at it all.
I appreciate what you're saying, and I think it's critical for us to talk about that because, I mean, let me ask you this. How difficult, and we just got a few minutes left, how difficult is it to keep all this information current about the manager?
Well, it's very difficult because you have to know what questions you need to ask, first of all. You have to know how to spot a problem with a particular fund, and that's not always easy to do in advance. Certainly not when you're dealing with lagging data. Mutual funds typically post their data quarterly, so you might be looking at fund holdings that are 2 or 3 months behind sometimes. And so knowing how to spot that those problems can be tricky. You have to have good relationships with their management team, and you have to have be willing to make some tough decisions sometimes too. So not only does it mean you have to know real well what it is that you're buying, but you also have to know very well what your potential alternatives are if you have to make a change.
So that's going back to managing the risk of that particular portfolio. And they're doing that for, obviously, what their objectives are for that management group. Now, Scott, we were in a meeting this time last year, actually February of last year, when the Ukraine and Russian war broke out.
Right.
And we had a lot of our managers that we work with in that meeting. I was impressed with their reaction to the war.
I was too, and I think that's critical. You know, going back to, you know, Drew's comment about the data, you know, a lot of times from the third party sources where you compile a lot of this data, you are looking at old data, but that's where having those phone calls and those meetings or being with those managers in person, and especially during a stressful time, hearing how they're reacting, what are they doing, are they panicking or are they cool and collected and taking advantage of the opportunities? So that's just part of that, really digging a little deeper under the hood and saying, okay, I really want to know this guy and how he works, not only in the good times, but also in the bad times.
And I think what I like about it is some of our managers we work with for long periods of time. We know them personally. And again, when you're talking to them, you can understand they're not giving you a lot of data just to give you data. They're talking to you from a standpoint of they know you're serious about working with our client. They're serious about working with our clients, and they know that we're very serious about doing that. So it's bringing something to the table that I think, Drew, you do a fabulous job with that, and I think it's important for us to understand and to share with people that managing a manager is really what we do. At the end of the day, it's staying in contact, watching, having that personal relationship, doing the analytical data. I guess let me just ask this one question. What's the greatest value or benefit from all this levels of oversight that you do? What would you say at the end of the day is really for the small investor?
For the small investor, mutual funds, pooled investments in general, but mutual funds in particular, really make that possible and make it easy. And not only do you have access to a diversified portfolio of, you know, the great companies of America, but you also have access to the great investment managers of America as well.
I think that's the critical part, and I like what you're saying. If you just tuned in, my guest, Drew Johnson, Scott Jordan, we've been talking about managing the managers. When we come back after the break, Scott's going to pick up a subject that we just didn't finish last week, and a lot of people want to hear the rest of it. It's really about avoiding some common estate planning mistakes, some basics that you just need to know about. We've talked about durable power of attorney, springing powers, but he's going to dive into that little bitty subject called your last will and testament and why you need that. Thank you so much for sending your questions. You always send them to Jim, J-I-M, 901-683-0989. We appreciate it. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Jim Shoemaker. This is Talk Money.
This material represents an assessment of the market environment at a specific point in time and is not intended to be a forecast of future events or a guarantee of future results. This information is not investment advice or recommendation. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Investments will fluctuate and when redeemed may be worth more or less than when originally invested. Financial professionals do not provide specific tax or legal advice, and this information should not be considered as such. You should always consult your tax or legal advisor regarding your own specific tax or legal situation.
Helping you make the most of your money. Talk Money with Jim Shoemaker on News Talk 98.9.
Neither Shoemaker Financial nor Securian Financial Services are affiliated with Delois Williamson, Kim Lane, or Jared Haddad. The views and opinions expressed are those of Delois Williamson, Kim Lane, and Jared Haddad only and have not been presented on behalf of or endorsed by Securian Financial Services, Inc. or Shoemaker Financial.
Helping you make the most of your money. It's time for Talk Money. Now, your host, Jim Shoemaker.
Welcome back. I'm Jim Shoemaker. Reminding you, just simply, if you've got a question for us, send it to Jim, 901-683-0989, or to talkmoney@shoemakerfinancial.com, and we'll get your question on the air. Drew, I got one question because I think it's a question that it's so important that we kind of pass over it, but we're talking about these professional managers. What is it that sets a professional manager apart, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, you can talk to some, and if you ever hear one that sounds like they're talking about, oh, well, we think such and such is going to happen in the next year, so, you know, we're buying this, you know, that's an amateur talking. A professional talking is going to give you some idea of what their shopping list is and that they've had this shopping list for a while. Just like a deliberate, patient consumer who wants to buy a car at a certain price or a house at a certain price or whatever it may be, but they really want to get a good bargain, that's how you tell a real professional manager. And what they're going to tell you is if the world looks like it's just going downhill, they're going to tell you they're not terribly concerned about it because they have cash on hand and they're waiting for this or that to go on sale so they can buy more of it and they're not worried about it.
And that's their shopping list you're talking about.
That's right. That's their shopping list. So a manager that's focused purely on their shopping list, that's how you tell a real professional manager from someone who thinks they're a real professional manager but really isn't.
Wow. You know what? That's powerful information.
Drew's coming with it again today.
He's coming with it. Always does a great job. Thanks, Drew. Appreciate you, man. That's always good. How to manage the managers? That's what he's been talking about. Scott, I want to ask this question. We were talking about this last week, but when we talk about last will and testament, we were talking about estate planning. I asked you the question last year, who needs estate planning? Let's start there again, and then I really want to talk about last will and testament.
Well, I think like we talked last week, you know, there's this a bit of a misconception that estate planning is only for the wealthy, but that is simply not true. Everybody needs to have an estate plan. Now, it doesn't have to be overly complicated, and certainly the more stuff that you have to pass on, the more complex that may be, but really, your last stewardship decision that you're going to make in life is who's going to get your stuff, right? And so you can only decide who's going to get your stuff before you die. So it's good to sit down, work through all this. We talked about that kind of basic package of having the will, the durable powers of attorney for both financial and health care. And then that last document is kind of that living will that tells, you know, your wishes of what you want regarding your health care. But that's kind of a basic package that I would recommend for everybody to have.
Everybody. So the key is, so let's talk about the last will and testament. You say your stuff.
Who's going to get your stuff?
We're talking about real and personal property.
Right.
So that's your truck, that's your socks, your...
It could be your house, could be, you know, anything. Any accounts that are owned individually, that would pass through the will.
So if I don't have a will, I mean, if I happen to be, that's called intestate.
Yep.
I know the state sets up a will for you and will dictate it.
Yep.
But it, are you saying that something that I would want to go to my kids might not go to my kids?
It might not. And even more specifically, what I've seen, because I know in the state of Tennessee, a wife is entitled to a third or a child share. So let's say in a situation where you would want everything to go to your wife to make sure she's taken care of, without a will to dictate that, it would be done through the state of Tennessee. So, you know, that may not be exactly how you want things to pass. And that is your estate plan if you don't have one, by the way. I'll go back and say everybody really has one. It's just you're either going to decide, or the state that you live in, the state you reside in, will decide how your stuff's going to pass.
That is so critical for us to understand. Let me share with you, though. Financial professionals like Scott and myself do not provide specific tax or legal advice. And this information that we're sharing with you should not be considered as such. We're just talking about what we see all the time. You should always consult your tax and legal advisor regarding your own specific tax and legal situation. But we're talking about, because we see it as we're doing a plan, we see people that think they've got this done or never thought about it. So back to your stuff,
mm-hmm.
All your stuff going, you need a, what about a guardian? So many people think that, that I don't need a guardian. Why does a person need a guardian for children?
Well, that goes back to, you know, do you want, if something were to happen to, let's say a couple with young children, if something were to happen to you, do you want the state to decide who's going to care for your children?
You're talking about both of them or individually? Just one passes away.
Well, it would be both in that instance.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, in most cases, the children are going to go with the surviving parent. If you don't decide who's going to take care of your kids, then the state's going to decide. And that could be a fight among relatives, by the way. I mean, you could have two different sets
of
in-laws.
Two sets of grandparents, yeah, I mean,
it could get really ugly, and I've seen that happen.
Yep.
So that's another important reason to have that will, is so that you can name that guardian that you would want to take care of your children in the event something happened to both of you.
You know, those are, you know, we don't put an emphasis on that, but the guardian is the person who's going to take care of your children.
That's a big one.
That's a big issue. That's taking care of the education side.
Right.
Now, financially, you're going to set something up for them, and that'll take care of financially, but that guardian is really one's making
Very
decisions.
Important.
About,
Very important.
Well, so don't not put that into a will
right.
in the case of a common disaster.
And an attorney that guides you through that process. And I do recommend people, you know, of course, there's ways to go out and do a will on your own. And in the state of Tennessee, you can even have a handwritten will or a holographic will. But I do encourage you to sit down with a legal professional and talk through that, because they're going to ask you those questions that you might not think of. And they're also going to get that proper legal language in that document so that there are no issues with it. So I know there's an expense to that. Nothing's free. And a lot of people want to shortcut that and go maybe on the internet and create one on their own, which, by the way, that's better than nothing. But I would encourage people to sit down with an attorney and have them walk through this process with them.
And what about a trust for children? I mean, I ended up getting called one time by the courts to come down and have to be, I became the ad litem, you know, and the problem was, nobody had set this up, and both was a common
right.
disaster. And so just to manage it, because the judge said, you're going to be court ad litem and you're going to take care of everything. And that was not something I was able to pass out
right.
on to someone else, because we were able to work with a judge. But it was an issue because they just hadn't done the planning.
Yeah.
What about that?
And you can do that through your will, by the way. You don't have to have a trust in place that owns everything before death. You can have a testamentary trust designed in the will that would be set up upon your death to take care of those children. So there's a lot of different ways you can organize that or put that together. But that's just another one of those critical pieces, because without that, you know, the assets are kind of just out there. You're not going to be able to pay. Let's say you have some assets that you're passing on. They're not going to be able to go to minor children. There's going to be somebody that's going to be a custodian or a guardian
that's
over those
assets.
That's
exactly what happened in my case. These were minor children.
And that may not necessarily be the person that you want managing all that. And sure, they're supposed to, by law, manage those for the benefit of the children, but they kind of have total rights to that. So, you know, having a trust in place that that has the parameters gives you a little more protection around that. So that's a good idea. And that goes back to just having a legal professional put this together for you, because they're going to help you think through all those decisions.
And that's so critical. Back to, what about an executor or somebody that's your legal representative to settle the estate to make sure it all goes where it's supposed to?
And that's a very important decision. Again, that's something that you name in the will. That's the person that's in charge of gathering all your assets together and eventually giving those to whoever you've named those to. So it's important that you pick a person to do that for you that you trust and that has kind of the ability to work through that type of situation or has the knowledge they need to distribute those assets fairly.
I like what you said at the beginning. Who needs an estate plan?
Everybody. Everybody needs one. And I followed that up with everybody has one. It's either by design or by default, right? You have one because you've gone out and put it together, or by default, you're just saying, I'm going to let the state make those decisions for me.
And what you're saying is you're providing for the future of your spouse, your children, and this avoids probate sometimes if you do it correctly, and supervision, and all these things can happen. You just don't need to take chance with this.
Absolutely.
Make sure you're doing something about that. And let me remind you, we as professionals, financial professionals, Scott and I, both certified financial planners, do not provide specific tax or legal advice. That's important. And this information should not be considered as such. You should always consult your tax and legal advisor regarding your own specific tax and legal situation, which is exactly what Scott was talking about. Scott, we've got so much to cover about this. You know, it's so important.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'd like to come back next time and maybe look at revocable trust and family trust. A lot of trust. We'll come back and do that. It's other vehicles for an estate plan and plays an integral part for everybody's estate. Scott, you always do a great job, man. Thank you so much. Well, we've been talking about things, about financial things. I mean, estate planning and, of course, how to manage the managers that are managing your money. But I've got some guests that I am so pleased to have in the studio with me today. They're going to talk about Myeloma Action Month. That's really what's going on in the month of March. These are people, they're friends of mine, that we all get to share something in common, and that is that we have multiple myeloma. And this is about telling you how to be aware of what's going on. We want to raise awareness about this particular cancer, because in reality, a lot of people, when they're told they have multiple myeloma, they have never heard of the subject before. Let me explain it to you. Multiple myeloma is a cancer of the bone marrow plasma cells. Now, what really that means is your blood, your plasma cells, who makes all kinds of things for you, begins to deteriorate, and you may have anemia, you may feel fatigued, you may actually break a bone. All of these are things that could occur with you having multiple myeloma, and you may not even know about it. So let me tell you who my guests are, and I am excited to introduce you to Kim Lane, Dolores Williamson, and Jared Haydad. Guys, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Now, Dolores, you're going to go first. Ladies first, Jared. I'm sorry. That's just the way it goes. Dolores, you are a patient, and I want to talk about, how did you discover that you had multiple myeloma? And tell me a little bit about that journey.
Thank you so much for having me on, Jim. It is such a pleasure, and it's such a joy to work with you in our support group. I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma in June of 2021. It started out, I was having back pains, what I thought was muscle spasms, or I had sprained a muscle or something like that. And I kind of ignored it for a while, and it went on, and it started getting a little worse. And I was scheduled to fly out the next day, headed to Florida. And so I thought, let me go to the emergency room and see what's going on with my back, because it was just annoying. And I went to the emergency room. Of course, they was taking too long. It was like 12. I was like, let me get away from here. I got a flight to catch at 6 o'clock in the morning. And so, of course, I left and went to Florida. And there it was getting a little worse. And my daughter, she had had some little back problems. So she was telling me how to move and how to, you know, kind of work it a little bit. And I got home that Friday, and it was okay. And so then that Saturday morning, I got up and it was excruciating, and I ended up going to the emergency room. In the emergency room, they told me that I had multiple myeloma cancer.
So they did some kind of a blood work for you to do that, or they just looked at and decided that's what it was? I mean,
no, they actually did X-ray and MRI.
MRI.
And from there, they was like, you have multiple myeloma cancer.
Wow. And so you had back pain, and that was the kind of the mental mindset was going on with you. See, when I was diagnosed, I had no reason. I had no symptoms, none whatsoever.
Wow.
And the reality was, I'd been hunting in Nebraska and in South Dakota and running up and down sloughs. And literally, I come home and I get an insurance physical.
Yeah.
For some estate planning, and they come back and say, you've got a little blood work problem here. You need to. And I'd been bitten by a spider.
Oh,
and
wow.
I thought, oh, that's what's caused it. So I did that. Then they come back and said, nah, we think you need to go get tested. Of course, they did some tests and eventually diagnosed with. And I never heard of multiple myeloma.
Right.
And so, Jared, what about you? You were diagnosed in the same thing. How did you find out that you had multiple myeloma?
It started as an itch in my lower back.
There you go.
And to be perfectly honest, I thought it was an old sports-related injury.
Sure.
And I had gone through earlier MRIs for a bulging disc, and these are things that are 20 years ago. Well, I was at a mountain bike race, and I had finished, and the pain was just unbearable. So the next morning, and I had, to be perfectly honest, I had sat on these symptoms for about 5 or 6 months, and I went into an ortho doctor here in Memphis, and he gave me an X-ray, and the X-ray picked up a mass that was in my lower spine. They called me in for a CT scan. The CT scan identified a lot more masses throughout my skeleton system, lesions throughout my bones, and then they brought me in for some blood work and ultimately a biopsy, and that's where they identified the myeloma.
Yeah, I had to do the biopsy, and then, of course, when I went to the doctor, I went down to MD Anderson because that's just what they suggested, and the same thing. I mean, I walk in, the guy says, you're asymptomatic. You probably don't have the disease. The same, you know, kind of that mindset, and then they come in and they say, after a week of studies and comes back, they said, no, not only do you have it, you got lesions. So literally being misdiagnosed would have been a major problem from our standpoint, and that is so critical, and I appreciate that.
And much like you, Jim, I had never heard of this disease.
Oh, absolutely.
So it was a big shock, and at that point, it was my journey to begin to understand and learn more about this, and you know, hopefully we can get this message out to others.
And my, just want to add on to it, my pain was coming from a compressor fracture in my spine. I had lost bone marrow, actually, and it caused my bone to compress. And it was bone against bone that I was experiencing. It felt like my back had broken in two.
If you just tuned in, I am privileged to have three very dear friends, Kim Lane, Delois Williamson, and Jared Haydad. We're talking about Multiple Myeloma Action Month. March is designated as kind of awareness time for you. And again, multiple myeloma is a cancer of the bone marrow plasma cells. And as you're listening to us, you may find out that you can have multiple myeloma and not know it. It's not like some other diseases, some other cancers. But the good part about it is we've all got stories of what God has done for us and how God's moved through and how things have just literally what's going on. When I was diagnosed 15 years ago, they were true drugs. Today, there's 13 active drugs and two that are in trial. Lots of stuff going on treating this particular disease. Kim Lane, now you're not a patient. You are that divine appointed individual.
Well, thank you, Jim.
That all of us have to have. And that's the caregiver.
Yes.
Amen. No questions about it. What's a caregiver do?
Well, it's a big role to be a caregiver. There are several things that caregivers can do for the patients. And I think there's some practical things like make a plan, write down all the doctor's appointments. Sometimes the patients are overwhelmed with this new diagnosis and everything they have to do. So do some practical things. Medications. There's a lot of medications you might have to be dealing with. Have a written schedule. Here's your medications and when you need to take them. Also, as a caregiver, it might be different for a spouse because I'm used to voicing my opinion quite frequently, I might add.
I'm married to somebody like that.
That's right. So as a spouse, it's a little different from someone who maybe their loved one is not their spouse, but you do have to take a step back and let the patient make some of the decisions, most of all the decisions really, about what treatment they choose. You can have great conversations with pros and cons. You know, let's make a list of pros and cons. But ultimately, it is the patient's decision. And once they've made that decision, as a caregiver, you really need to offer the support.
I think that support is so critical, and I know we have support. Dolores, your daughter does a great job.
Yes.
Your wife, Jared, does a phenomenal job. And again, my wife does a phenomenal job. But guys, let me ask you this. What would you say, Jared, is kind of the action steps for anybody listening that says, hey, I've got a symptom of a back issue, or maybe I've got this or that, or I feel tired a lot. What would be your steps that you would encourage them to think about?
First, you have to understand that you're going to have to advocate for yourself. And to go through the medical system, you're going to have to start to begin to find answers. And once you find answers through blood tests, through x-rays, through biopsies, depending on how far you have to go with the process, once you get through those, then you're going to have to take those results. And ultimately, you're going to want to find a specialist, somebody that focuses on whatever that ailment is, whatever that disease is, and you're going to have to pursue that. It may be in your hometown, it may be out of town. And those are things that you're going to have to decide upon yourself, and don't settle for the simple answers. Don't settle for no. You're going to want to find somebody who is actually a specialist in these things that you're pursuing, trying to get to the bottom of it all.
And I like what you started out with. You got to be your own advocate. I know we're all part of a support group. And Kim, I remember when you and Tim showed up, that was really what you were looking for.
Exactly.
Is the information and trying to learn to be an advocate and understanding. That's a big deal.
That was the first thing I did after his diagnosis, was research it. And part of that was, is there a support group here? And I was lucky enough that we have one here. And called you, and I think I had you on the phone for an hour. Every question under the sun, and but I certainly appreciated that conversation, and the support group has definitely helped us on our journey.
Well, I think that's what we're saying. Awesome. Being an advocate, you have the support group, just being aware. And that's what we're talking about. March is Multiple Myeloma Action Month. It's about an awareness of a particular disease. Dolores, I'm going to give you a few minutes to tell us you went through a procedure, and then I'm going to go to Jared because he's done one. What was your procedure to get you to this point of where you're around this table?
I started out with 6 months of chemotherapy. I did that, and then they even talked about hypoplaster for my back. And my children said, absolutely not. It was the danger of me being paralyzed for the rest of my life if I opt to do that. And so we didn't do that. My back actually healed up on its own. And so I did that. And then I had a stem cell transplant done after 6 months of chemo.
And it's not easy. But with that, you got good results?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. As you stated before, God really carried me through after I got from the depression and the actually just being real about it and not being in denial.
Jared, now you didn't do a stem cell transplant. You took a bigger step, something that has actually only been around for us for a couple of years and really moving in a great direction.
Yep, that's correct. And I will say I've gotten lucky in a couple of regards. I did have a friend who worked for one of the major drug manufacturers. So going into this process, I learned about what these standard medications are, the chemos that Dolores had mentioned. And I went through 6 months of that chemotherapy to try to beat down the disease. And then I was invited to participate in a clinical trial. This is a cutting edge treatment that is it's called CAR-T. And it is used to basically go into your body and attack the cancer. It is designed to use your body's own immune system. So I had to really think through my decision on going through CAR-T and decide whether or not I wanted to do a stem cell transplant, which has been a very common standard of care for decades. And it's been successful, but it was a decision I had to make as to whether or not I wanted to try this new cutting edge treatment and see how it worked for me.
Multiple Myeloma Action Month. We just want to make you aware. This is a disease, a cancer that is very treatable. Guys, thank you so much for taking time out for
thank
the day.
Thank you for having us.
It's just great to see your smiling faces.
Thank
well,
you, Jess.
Two out of the three. Whatever can I say?
Sorry about that.
Sorry. I want to thank my guests, Delois Williams, Kim Lane, Jared Haydad, Drew Johnson, of course, and Scott Jordan in the earlier part of the program. Next week, my guest, Ted Miner, choosing your retirement strategy. And Steve Anderson, we're going to get an update on the market and what's all going with this banking crisis. That's Saturday morning at 7 a.m. and Sunday at 9 a.m. I want to thank our producer, Tyler Springs. Always does a great job. Guest and content coordination, Francis Fortner. Production and marketing assistant, Lauren Norsworthy. And compliance officer, Tommy Armstrong. Thank you so much for listening. We're here for you. And we're here every week helping you make the most of your money. I'm Jim Shoemaker. This is Talk Money.
Jim Shoemaker, Drew Johnson, and Scott Jordan are registered representatives and investment advisor representatives of Securian Financial Services, Inc., securities dealer, member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor. Shoemaker Financial is independently owned and operated.
Helping you make the most of your money. This has been Talk Money with Jim Shoemaker on News Talk 98.9.